The elegy, to me, and why I say it's fierce, is because it's endured millennia. It's been with us forever. It's the first form. Joy and sorrow, they share a very complex ecosystem. They are one, you know, and you cannot have one without the other. And I believe that joy can be amplified by sorrow. That's how we understand it. So the three things that I most love about poetry and what I'm interested in is mystery, presence, and intimacy.
Got it.
Okay, that's scary.
I'm totally prepared feeling now.
Spook.
You smoking a regular cigarette and a vape at the same time?
I put the cigarette out. Shut up. I just got the cigarettes. Shut up.
All right, so.
Alrighty.
Happy Father's Day.
Oh, great. Nothing but ghosts for me. But, yeah. You know, the father comes up in this. You know, I have a few things to say about this once we get into it. But, yeah, why don't you, like, do whatever you do to kick it off? Do you have something you say?
Yeah.
I'm Bianca Stone, and I'm a crazy person.
Totally. I'm the mad woman at the mic.
There you go. It's nice to see you, though, and I'm happy to do this. I'm happy to do this with you.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have you. I mean, I've been wanting to have you on the podcast anyway, but I feel like Roca, you know, I feel a kinship to Roca in the way that I feel a kinship to you as a poet. So I feel like we deal in the same kinds of themes.
We do. And and there's a lot I can say about that too, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get there. Hi, I'm Bianca Stone. Welcome to the Odin Psyche podcast. We're here again, folks. I'm talking on the podcast today with my dear friend and colleague, Peter Gizzi. And we're working through the Duino elegies. And today we're looking at Rainer Maria Rilke's the fourth elegy. And I've been wanting to have Peter on the podcast anyway to talk about his poetry and his interests. And I knew that the fourth elegy would be a perfect one in which to do that, especially today when we're recording on Father's Day. Peter Gizzi teaches at UMass MFA program. He's the author of numerous books of poetry and chapbooks, including Now It's Dark, In Defense of Nothing, Selected Poems from 1987 to 2011. And Peter, I felt like it was so perfect to have you on for a Duino Elegy episode because your most recent book is called Fierce Elegy. And these are all from Wesleyan University Press. So, Peter's books, I mean. So I was thinking of starting off today meditating on the word elegy itself, because in fact, it's not something we've talked about yet on the podcast. And the way that Rilke uses the word elegy in this collection and the elegy as a form isn't traditionally, I think, how we think of elegy in this book, in these poems. And wow, I said that really shittily. I'll say it again. I was really interested in the way that Rilke uses the elegy form and even decided to use elegy as the form for these poems, because it's not a traditional use of the elegy. It's not as straightforward as we would think. And that said, his obsession with the unseen and seen elements of living and the dead is pervasive in this book, as is love and loss. And there's so much nuance to these terms.
Yes.
That he explores in the elegies, and that I see you exploring, Peter, in your poems and in Fierce Elegy. So I wanted you to start by talking about how you see the elegiac working as a form in your own poems, but in poetry in general.
Sure. It's great to be here with you, Bianca. It's always lovely to have the occasion to be in conversation. The elegy to me, and why I say it's fierce, is because it's endured millennia. It's been with us forever. It's the first form. And if you take it at its most elemental, to lament is also an act of love. But you're right about the way that Rilke uses elegy. I think he uses it in a way that actually is, for me, I feel akin with, because, I mean, there's so many things to say. For instance, if we forget what we've lost, then we've lost everything, basic. But the other piece of it is joy and sorrow, they share a very complex ecosystem. They are one. And you cannot have one without the other. And I believe that joy can be amplified by sorrow. And that's how we understand it. And so to me, the elegy is never really a form. It's more like an environment or, an orientation to the world. Can I keep talking? Should I keep? Because the most basic way, why I liked it and why I use it here, and why probably my soul has always been interested in this particular vantage, and I've been reading Rilke since I've been 20, is that we live in this moment, particularly now in the 21st century, where there's, because of digital culture, we're living in this incredibly accelerated, moment of all of these interlocking crises that have absolutely no resolution. So why is the elegy useful then? Because the one way, because nobody can agree on anything, right, out there. And so the one thing that we can come to rest in and say, this is a reasonable way to understand objective reality, which is periodicity. Nothing is here forever. We're all just here for a moment, right? And it's like the whole human record is not even the life of a gnat in the face of the sun. We're basically a mirage. So the idea of periodicity, right, that everything's in a constant state of change, to me, okay, so we can all agree on that basic fact. And so that's a ground. And then within that ground, there's a couple of things. Oppen says the self is no mystery. The mystery is we want to be here. We have something to stand on. We want, what do you say, the act of being more than oneself.
That
If
seems
we
like something Rilke would be
interested in,
interested in,
well,
for sure.
I think Rilke is tapping into, like, what poetry is all about, which is basically how do you make something absolutely present while it's absolutely haunted? How do you make something that's always forward-looking while it's also, backward-looking? And so, and it basically disrupts a notion of linear time. It disrupts the notion of the clock. It makes us realize that, time is like, it's an outer force. And Rilke does have this moment at Duino Castle, a place I went to when I was 24. I made a pilgrimage there.
Love that.
And I was staring through the gates, and there was an elderly gentleman, elegant man, pruning a rose bush, it would turn out. And I was standing there, and he's looked at me, and he went, "Bravato." He like waved his hand, "Go away." And I didn't leave. And then this woman came down, probably his assistant, and said, "This is private property. Why are you here?" I told her my love of, made a pilgrimage, the Duino elegies, Rilke is so important to me. And so then she went back, and then she came back, and then she let me on the grounds, and I got to
Oh.
walk the cliffs. But that said, he has an experience which he talks about a year later in a notebook in Spain, that when he was there in the grounds, he also has this incredibly heightened sense of connection with the natural world. And it means a couple of things. For him, it's a mystical experience. And in fact, when we're actually in total tuning with the natural world, or the just the world around us, that is, a fairly enlightened way of being. But it struck him, and it also said that it had no language for him. And then he goes on to say that I was on the other side of nature. And that's interesting, right?
It's
Because
so
Rilke
interesting.
is really interested in besidedness, to be adjacent to, because, I don't know. I mean, poetry's always been a haunted medium. I mean, just basically because it uses language, which is bigger than us, older than us. It doesn't live in us, we live in it. So the notion of dictation, that language comes to one, makes complete sense. And so for the elegies and for poetry, and why I identify, and maybe you, is that when I'm writing, I'm not speaking. I'm being spoken. I'm being spoken, right? The pronoun I doesn't belong to Peter Gizzi or Bianca Stone. We share it. It belongs to everyone. It's a really interesting thing. Like, we think this, individualness, but the I is actually wound and sprung with all of this historical consciousness and all these affiliated voices. And when we sit down to write as poets, those energies are with us, That, I mean, you wouldn't be here, I wouldn't be here if we didn't read things that changed our lives, that gave us wings, So those voices are forever now wedded to whatever voice we create on the page.
It's so interesting. You bring up so many good points,
I'm
but
sorry. I talk too much.
it's a good thing to have a problem with on a podcast. But his being that statement, I was on the other side of nature, and it was without language, but and also that beingness in the world, that seamlessness with. There's this element of the natural landscape that is so important to the Duino Elegies because that first line came to him at that location on the wind, with that dramatic backdrop. But it also was the context of his life. It also was the context of his depression and what all that led to that moment and the things at hand that were part of that. So there's this idea of the greater consciousness of work at work in the natural landscape, in the natural world, which he's always talking about. The difference being we are the ones who think about it in almost like binaries, right? So in that in the fourth elegy, when he's saying, oh, at this at in one moment, like the moment that we bloom, we also think of fading. So we can't, the lion isn't aware of his majesty any more than he's aware of his weakness. I mean, in terms of thought, in terms of thinking about it to a point of almost like paralysis, maybe is the issue too, is that we're unable to be in the world a little bit because of our language that, because being on maybe on this side of that idea of language, but there's this idea of language, the language, I don't know, the other side of nature,
I know.
where language maybe is when we think of that when you think of that where is that unseen force that is bringing the language to us? If the I is an I who's speaking, if not I, not I, but the wind blows through me. Well, how is that intelligence and consciousness and beingness of the wind, where is that coming from? And what is the language on that side of things if we're on this side, right? So we won't know. We don't know. We're half-filled masks who only half understand everything. We're getting ahead a little bit. But there was something else you
Fine.
said. There was something else you said that was I had been thinking about before we started talking. And is your incredible poem in your newest book called I Am Who Sent Me?
Yeah, everyone loves that poem. That poem was like a total enigma to me. Literally, everyone quotes it in reviews.
Everyone does? That's so
It's
funny.
crazy because
Oh.
it's the most mysterious. It's like,
Oh,
what
well,
is.
that's there you go. Right. Well, you were basically saying what you were saying in that. I mean, I love the whole
Yeah.
book, beginning to end, is all
It's a piece of a
it's all
piece.
that poem too. That's
Yeah.
interesting. But there's something you said in the first line, to have died in youth and remain.
Exactly.
Now, there's a different kind of elegy that occurs with the living, and that seems to be one of mourning, various deaths. There's right. There's a sort of like I was thinking of the death of selves, or like certain parts of us that are killed in childhood and then that we're haunted by, right? And this ephemeral, this constant ephemeral aspect of being alive in this world is always at work, then we're constantly being haunted. we're constantly mourning, we're constantly killing different and being killed in different ways, psychically too,
Well, things are
right?
just
So,
changing. Everything just ch like all matter is
right.
in a constant state of change, you know? So, you know, I mean, because to me, like the elegy in this instance, the way you're
Yeah.
speaking to it is not really melancholy as much as it is survival. It's like, okay, this is the condition of being. Everything's in
Right.
a state of change. Nothing, okay, I accept it, right? And so to me, it's like, okay, so then how do we survive these things? This is a way that I have a valence in which I can kind of like, I don't know, like just inhabit that notion of surviving. And
But it's weird that elegy would, in many ways, be about living.
it
And
is.
I it's
Again, how can you know about life if you don't understand death, right?
right.
So that line that you talked about, to have died in youth and remain to be good with that, that's a very personal line.
Right,
It's
right.
interesting. So many people like seem to relate to it. For me, you know, it's like because it's Father's Day. So, you know, when I was 12 in the living room, waiting for my father to come home with my mother watching a movie, they interrupted the show and said a plane has crashed in Albany. And then they showed us the crash, and it was my father's plane.
Jesus, yeah.
So that was a really severe rending moment in my early
Right.
life, which took me many years to kind of unpack, right, and understand.
Of course, yeah.
But now I realize I could not be who I am without that,
Right.
and that I've honored it by, you know, like I don't name things. Like I don't write autobiographical verse. I don't name them. Like to
Right,
me,
right.
I write out of it, and to name it to me only kind of, oh, if it cheapens it, it just doesn't interest me. I'm interested in the kind of larger horizon. But the thing is, what it gave me, Bianca, what I realized, the gift that I was given from that, you know, very, you know, I don't know, it's a tragic moment, you know, learning that things could just change in a second and so haphazardly. But what I grew up with, I realized, is a native understanding of irrevocability. And it's always, and that loss gave me eyes. It gave me eyes, and I could actually then finally see.
Yeah.
And seeing in the Rilke moment when he's connected to nature is like it's that moment when, you know, we've all had, at least I have, I'm sure you have, is that all of a sudden you're standing and the world is just the volume's turned up and the world is just happening all around you. And you realize very, you know, the grieving subject understands this thing that Rilke is talking about in the sense that it's got nothing to do with you. It's like the world has absolutely nothing to do with you. It's just ongoing. And sometimes I've experienced that sense of ongoingness in the sense that I'm just a piece of it, like a tree or anything else. It's like it's not about me, you know, and it really can't be finally uncombed. But then within that, what's beautiful is that we do find a way to connect and to love and to remember and to honor. So it's an interesting dichotomy, but it is a mystical thing when you realize that you're beside the world, you know? It's like to be in the world, but not of it, or that beautiful moment in Nightwood in Juna Barnes' book when Nora Flood goes to see the doctor and she climbs six stairs and he's very impoverished. She's kind of shocked that this brilliant interlocutor, larger than life, lives in this one room and he's wearing a gown and a wig and he's rouged. And she's going to ask him about the night. And then you know, she sees the doctor and she's shocked. And he says, "See, you can ask me anything." So, and then this is what she says, though. And I've always loved this. She said, "He dresses to lie beside himself, who was so constructed that love for him could only be something special." And I've always loved that because the idea is I can love and I can be beside it. And I realize that there's both the experience of, you know, of the present, but then there's also this other ongoing open time, right? And poems go into open time. That's where they go. It's like they disrupt the clock, which is law, labor, property, patriotism, patriarchy, etc. and it disrupts that particular mechanism, and it opens up like these elegies, like our poetry, hopefully, it opens up to what I want to call fugitive time, or open time, or sacred time, or ritual time. Another time signature. And that to me is one of the great mechanics and one of the great things that poetry can do. And that's always interested me because all of a sudden I'm present to something much bigger than just where I'm dwelling in the moment. Like the present is so much larger. And he does this in that last moment. It's interesting. I began with interlocking crises, and it begins with the thing you're talking about. It's like we can comprehend flowering and fading. It's like the mind is disturbed. It can't come to rest. It can choose this, it can choose that, which has kind of like been so accelerated now with all the various media we're forced to live with. But then he comes at the end, finally, he works through it, but he says, who will show a child just as it is? Who will place it within its constellation with a measure of distance in its hand? Who will make its death from gray beard that grows hard, or leave it there within the round mouth like the choking core of a sweet apple? Minds of murderers are easily divined, but this, though, death, the whole of death, even before life's begun, to hold it all so gently and be good, this is beyond description. That ending is remarkable because it's kind of what we're talking about, to have died in youth and be good. It's interesting. I don't know. I mean, people are always making me think about that line. But it's here in this poem.
Do you want to read the, why
Which
don't you
one?
read, why don't
Read
you
what?
read the fourth elegy?
Which one do you want me to read, the snow or the which one do you want me to read?
Well, I have the snow here,
Let's
so
do that. Let's do
yeah.
that. Okay,
All
so
right, so we're reading Edward Snow's translation of the
wrote
fourth
this fourth
elegy.
elegy. Yeah. Okay. The fourth elegy. O trees of life, how far off is winter? We're in disarray. Our minds don't commune like those of migratory birds left behind and late. We force ourselves suddenly on winds and fall, exhausted on indifferent waters. Blooming makes us think of fading, and somewhere out there, lions still roam, oblivious in all their splendor to any weakness. We, though, even when intent on one thing wholly, already feel the cost exacted by some other. Conflict is our next of kin. Aren't lovers always reaching borders, each in the other, despite the promise of vastness, royal hunting, home? Then, for an instant's virtuoso sketch, a ground of contrast is prepared, laboriously, so we can see it. For they're very clear with us. We don't know our feelings' contour, only what shapes it from outside. Who hasn't sat anxiously before his heart's curtain? It rose, the scenery for parting, easy to understand, the familiar garden swaying slightly, then the dancer, not him, enough. However light his entrance, he's in disguise and turns into a burgher who enters his kitchen to reach his living room. I loathe watching these half-filled masks give me the puppet. At least it's real. I can take the hollow body and the wire and the face and its pure surface. Right here, I'm out in front. Even when the lights go out, even when someone says to me, it's over, even when from the stage a gray gust of emptiness drifts toward me, even when not one silent ancestor sits beside me anymore, not a woman, not even the boy with a brown squint eye, I'll sit here anyway. One can always watch. Aren't I right, you, father, from whom life turned so bitter when you tasted mine? That first murky influx of what would feed my drives, who kept on sampling it as I grew older and intrigued by the aftertaste of so strange a future, tried looking through my vague upward gaze. You, father, who since your death have been here often in my hope, far inside me, afraid, forfeiting the equanimity the dead possess, whole kingdoms of equanimity from my bit of fate. Aren't I right? And you, woman, aren't I right? who loved me for that small, hesitating love for you I always veered from, because I felt the realm in your faces, even as I loved it, changing into world space where you were absent. What if I do choose to wait in front of the puppet stage? No, to stare with so much force that finally to counteract my stare, an angel will arrive here as an actor and jolt life into those hard husks. Angel and puppet, then finally the play begins. Then what we kept apart simply by our presence here conjoins. Then from the separate seasons of our life, that one great wheel of transformation arises above us, beyond us. The angel plays. The dying, surely they must guess how full of pretext is all that we achieve here. Nothing is what it is. Oh, childhood hours, when behind each shape there was more than mere past, and before us, not the future. True, we were growing, and often we spurred ourselves to grow up faster, half for the sake of those who had nothing left but their grownness. And yet, off alone, we were happy with what stayed the same. And we stood there in the space between world and plaything, upon a spot which, from the first beginning, had been established for pure event. Who shows a child just as he is? Who places him in a constellation and hands him the measure of distance and interval? Who makes a child's death out of gray beard that hardens, or leaves in it his round mouth like the core of a beautiful apple? Murderers are easily understood, but this, one's death, the whole reach of death, even before one's life is underway, to hold it gently and not feel anger is indescribable. So great. It's just, I mean, you could like pause at every four line. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, what did you respond to most just now, if you did?
For some reason, I really responded to then from the separate seasons of our life, that one great wheel of transformation arises.
I know, it's beautiful.
Okay, the angel and puppet, then finally the play begins. Then what we keep apart simply by our presence conjoin. So this, you know, and I've just ended my therapy. I just ended my weekly therapy, and so I've been thinking a lot about that event in your life, like the major event of coming to change, like really foundational change, and at the same time dealing with things that stay the same, and like even changes, that's even change is seeing that, seeing things that are constant and things that change, and trying to figure that out. But in that moment of that conjoining of understanding and contrasts and ambivalences and holding them together, even life and death, right? Even that blooming and fading idea, you know, when you come to a change in your life, it's almost like a moment of holding those two things at the same time in the hand, right?
Yeah.
But that when he said that great wheel, that seasons of our life, that one great wheel of transformation arises, I don't know, I just felt this, I felt that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a moment, I think, where he is, you know, almost accepting this notion that we bloom and fade at the same time, that the wheel is constantly changing and we're on this thing. But angel and puppet, right? I mean, like one's mystical and of the imagination, and the puppet is artifice, and yet it is also depicted and comes to life through imagination. It's an interesting choice, angel and puppet. It's like, so, you know, I mean, in one creepy way, is he saying we're just like funhouse dolls and the dead put words in our mouth? You
oh,
know?
Jesus.
You know what I'm saying? Is it dark like that? You know?
Well,
because you know who references that is Jack Spicer has those five imaginary elegies, and
Right.
he's definitely coming. I mean, he's Rilke. Yeah, it was
You
he
mean the
knew.
ones to Lorca?
No,
Oh.
earlier poems called just the imaginary elegies, and yeah, I mean, I could go
Well,
get.
the
Yeah, go. I mean, my mind just went somewhere else. Go ahead. But yeah,
Well,
Puppet and it.
I was I thought, I kept thinking of the importance of what he's getting at in this idea of the puppet and the half-filled masks. He keeps saying in this poem, "Aren't I right? Aren't I right? Aren't I right? Nothing is what it is." That he's trying to convince himself, I think, too. I think these things are shaky and comp and conflicting, but nothing is what it is a point he's making. That he embraces this performance, this scene, this cur even the curtain of the heart. Okay,
I know.
we're waiting for the curtain of the heart to part, the stage of the heart, the theater of a heart, and this scene, this theater, this act. Now, of course, what is that? That's art. That is art. That is people making art. Even the puppet is something that humans have built, right? Nothing else in nature is building a puppet. So there's this really interesting thing that's happening where he sees the natural animals and children as more authentic and seamlessly at in the world, and we are blind. We're half-filled masks who are actually blind because we think we're whole by through the lover or whatever, our denial and our delusion. But it's this there's something more authentic in the persona. Now, getting back to how you started this whole conversation, I'm not the I, right? The moment that, and you as a wonderful teacher would know this in terms of helping students understand the power of what they can do in a poem, the I is not the I. The I is this incredible opportunity to not be the I, and to be, and once you fully embrace the persona of self, and it's not like a gimmick, right? It's not like a gimmick of art. It's actually somehow getting at something of what it means to have language itself, is that there's this like performative persona self at work, and that we perform all the time, these little scenes of the of what we don't see, of what we don't understand about our own minds, are the and the unconscious, right? The unconscious, right? So we these performances of the unconscious. There's something about art that he's getting at here, I feel like, subtly,
Yeah, I think that's
or
really
even
lovely.
unconsciously.
I think that's lovely. And that what he's speaking to is art as this other valence, and maybe it's the true valence in terms of Rilke's imagination as a poet. But you're also right that if the pronoun I doesn't belong to, it's like a persona that one creates, it's an act, it's a theater, then there's also like, the body incarnate, the somatic instrument that's writing it is also just beside that persona, because it's not Peter Gizzi. We're just next to Peter Gizzi. And so that's a piece of it. It's like Walt Whitman, the voice he creates in those poems is not who he was, right? That's a made thing, that
But isn't
voice.
it, is there some element
And
that
now
he's
we want to say that that's the poet. This is what we do. And in a way, that is the poet, because the poet has now
right.
created a being. It's created a personhood,
Right, so I love this idea that in the idea, of course, the poet is maker, the poet as maker, that the poet in the act of writing the poem is maker and not poet. And this is important and mysterious, but there's something, okay, so this idea too of the fool and lying that's aligned with poets, but that's the way to get at a truer sense of reality, which I feel like that's what Rilke is, that's what he's saying in this poem. There's to use our there's an ontological curse in I think therefore I am, right? So there's this the act of our self-consciousness is a burden in the you know, it starts off so vehement in the beginning of this poem, except when we accept it and it embrace the performative act of it and create something out of it. And there's something to that weird move of having the angel come, right? So there's some element of divine interaction to complete the
circuit. I think you're speaking about this really. I it's really great, actually. It's very useful.
Useful personally.
Not always useful personally.
I'm like
I like the fact that you bring in therapy. It's like, stop it.
Stop it.
Yeah.
Stop bringing it up.
Well, it's there, but it's not there. Like, it's like, this is bigger than therapy.
Oh, I know. Therapy is just, it's so true because
you get to perform this other thing that you desire. It's like, you know, it's like poem, like we're voting. Like, what's a votive? It's a wish. It's a prayer. It's a desire. And we get to build another reality that's not linked entirely to family of origin or one's surroundings, right? It's like, it's not entirely just made of that. It's made of that and something else. So there's like the angel and the puppet, or this idea that it's a made thing, that it's a theater. So I never liked the therapeutic model,
You have to transcend the idea that the therapeutic model will address the autobiographical origins of your traumas in which to address why you do what you do, right?
And I think
have to transcend that. You could that becomes that you that falls away like old dead skin, you know? It becomes so in this creepy way meaningless, even though it still haunts you, you know, even though it's still.
So I tell you about this extraordinarily rended moment in my early life. It means nothing to say it. What's more interesting is it's how it's bloomed in me throughout my life and given me a way to to have eyes to be here. And in many ways, that is how I've honored that person. And it's like, it's so exhausting to be alive. It's just, it's so expensive. If you're at all awake, I mean, the news that comes in every day is just exhausting. It's just like, I don't know. I mean, where we're going and what we've become as a species is it's just like, it's so impoverished. I don't understand. And it's happening faster and faster in my life. I have years on you. So, you know, I spent the first 40 plus years of my life without any of this stuff, like in the world, you know, where there was none of this. And now it's like, I don't know. I don't think the human mind or the human is meant to move at the rate that computing does, or the digital world, or, you know, the phone we carry. We're not supposed to have that much information on us at any moment. And it's actually meaningless in a way to have it. So,
well, talk about not being present in the world, because I've talked about this with other people too, is that there's this anxiety that happens when you have social media and the computer and everything, where it feels like that's more of the real world than the real world is. And somehow,
well, it is for many people. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to address the real world. I've got to go onto the real world and check in, you know, like, and see how it's going on there. Like, I have to take a picture of this book I'm reading, because otherwise it's not real. You know, like, I have to make this event I'm at real by posting about it. And I don't want to like hate on, I don't want to, I'm not being black and white about it. Right.
No, it's a tool. I mean, the only reason I got on it, because I just use it for Peter Gizzi Industries, you know,
right.
I just let people know what's going on. Otherwise, I don't know how people know what's going
on
anymore.
And the wonderful friendships I've had with like-minded minds that I am so grateful for.
Yeah.
But, you know, Rilke would be shocked, because, I mean, it's a much harder time of it, of doing what he calls in-seeing, which he learned from Rodin, which is looking, 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 looking. And, you know, I've had these moments of like, you know, one, and I'll say this about what one thing that happened in psychoanalysis too is like I had this moment of being like, how much am I seeing outward? How much am I trapped in a kind of not seeing inward or outward? I'm in this sort of like liminal space of not seeing anything, you know? And it's I to I've been trying so hard to look at the world, you know, and look at nature and see things. And it's brutal too, like, you know, seeing birds get hit by cars in front of you and all the environmental devastation and everything that's we don't want to look. Of course we don't want to look. But
And then all the lives that are being taken and
all
senseless and war, you know.
disgusting war and violence is just it's so hard to look, but it's
But we are nature. I mean, the idea that, like, you know, what makes our hands makes everything else on the planet, and kind of basically it makes almost everything else that's in the multiverse, right? What we're made of is like made of everything. Like that, it's like I think if people actually just focused on the fact that it's like a total miracle and mystery to be here. We might actually celebrate the fact that we're not here for long, you know. Any rate, we got off topic.
I know we did. This is
But you're talking about the elegies, right? That we can keep.
true. Okay. So it's this part about the father is really weird too. You
It is.
father for whom life turned so bitter when you tasted mine. And it's not a capitalized father either. There is a, I mean, he uses the word bitter, but there's a bitterness in that line. Turned so bitter when you're whom you father for whom life turned so bitter when you tasted mine.
I know. And it's the same line in the snow. It's pretty much exact in the in the other one, in the
Oh, yeah.
Spender Leishman. I'm gonna look it up here in this other, you know, the one I first got, by the way, was this David Young translation. And let me just show you what it looks like. It's like Williams' variable foot,
Whoa.
and it works brilliantly because all those long Thurman clauses, then they just it's beautiful.
Oh,
Yeah,
that's so interesting.
this is an amazing translation. I loved it. But where the father thing, let's go
Okay,
there.
so that's at the
Don't you
top.
think I'm right, you father whose life tasted so bitter after you tasted mine, the first thick doses of my necessity, still tasting again and again as I grew up and intrigued by the aftertaste of such a strange future, tried out my cloudy gaze, you, my father, who so often since your own death have had fears about me, deep in my own hope, giving up the calm that the dead have, surrendering whole kingdoms of calm for my morsel of fate. So weird. It's like
Whole
thought
kingdoms of calm.
it just keeps turning, right? But this is the weird
Yeah,
part.
yeah.
You, my father, who so often since your own death have had fears about me. Like,
Yeah, like how would he even know that?
well, it's like it's a very interesting address. It's just like,
Yeah.
okay. I mean, you know,
It's so weird, like where he's speaking from, you know, and like.
Rosemary Waldrop, who I love, and who's like, you know, unimpeachably brilliant and a translator from the German and the French. You know, when I was younger, it's like I really love Rilke. She said, yes, that's I did too, but no longer.
Oh, really?
Well, just
Did
because
she give a
she
reason why?
just feels like it's you know, I think for her, it's just too like mystical,
Mm,
and
yeah.
she's actually into like, if you can't say it, it doesn't exist. I don't know. I just, yeah, it's just not, it's too soft for her in some way, or too romantic. I actually think it really speaks to her own background and how, in many ways, as one does, has to leave that, you know. And her father was into astrology, and he was into mystical things, and as was the Third Reich. So, you know, she was a little girl during that, and you know, it's interesting. Like, she can't listen to Mahler or Wagner, you know, those things
Okay.
are, so these very high
Yeah.
Teutonic things she's walked away from. Maybe she finds them that in their totality of vision, they can also be instruments of be misused. I don't know. It's interesting. But yeah, no, she kind of scoffed at me in my youth. It's something I remember. I didn't judge it, like, whatever. I think
Yeah, well,
I
it's
know
kind of a, it's
I
a blow
never
when somebody you
yeah.
are is like, oh, real good. Well, I
Like
you know, I
you'll grow up.
you'll grow out of that. I know people, are always like, oh, I don't read the Letters to a Young Poet. That's like only for young people. I read it recently and I was like, I didn't get this when I was younger. Like now I get
No,
it, like
no, I
I don't.
agree.
It's funny because I feel like it's easy. They were written to a young man, yes, but I think it takes time to see those. But it's different too
But
if
I
you grow
think,
up a German. But if you grow up German,
but
you
here's the, but here's the thing on those, right? So he's addressing a young man, but basically what they're really about is an opportunity for him to think about an art he spent his life in, right? So
yeah, right.
that's why they're not just for the young, right? They're for
No.
us because it's really like, a seasoned veteran, like
Yeah.
giving the benefit of their mind. And I always took away from that my favorite thing and what I liked about it when I was young was he copies out his sonnet, and that's like a great honor, right? And so I love this. I mean, when I was younger, I would, I would, like a commonplace book, I would write things with my hand of things that I read that I loved.
Me too.
And there's kind of a way of just like taking it into your body. It's a way of like
Yeah.
being with it in this other way
Yeah.
that's, and that was my favorite gesture in that book that I loved was that, and that was generous of him. And whether is it Christopher, whether he was happy with that, I don't know.
I think he was thrilled. I mean, he's kind of the reason they were published. I think he tracked down the,
He was very proud.
yeah.
I mean, but the Twino elegies, right? I mean, they're all of a piece. They do focus on different things, some on love, some on death, some on adulthood, some on childhood, some on the mystical. And but they're really kind of all just one vocal fabric. And even though what makes them really, to me, have such impact is that they were written over such a long period of time. And I guess what I love about Rilke and why I respect his art is that it's kind of also confident. As much as he despaired, he had to have some kind of incredible sense of equanimity because he could just take his time. And it was, years. What a
Yeah.
decade, right? And it's beautiful. It's like Stevens writes his first, he's published his first book when he's 44. Okay, whatever. He doesn't publish his next book for 13 years.
Wow.
And it's a 52-page book, Ideas of Order. It doesn't suck, by the way, but I'm just saying, but it's like
Yeah.
52 pages 13 years later. We think of Oppen 25 years.
Wow.
But
We're
just,
very rushed
well, that's the thing. And
nowadays.
there's way too much poetry. I mean, it's like I haven't written a poem. I mean, I'm not writing. It happens after I finish a book. I can't write if I don't have something to say, Bianca.
I hate that feeling.
And I don't want to, I don't write to write. I'm not one of those people. I mean, when I was younger, sure, it was an act of will, but now I realize it's way bigger than me. And it's such a privilege. It's such a
It's comforting
majesty.
to hear that. Some people are so prolific, and I feel all this pressure to like, I want so badly to write something, but I don't. I know I hate the feeling of things that haven't like, and I kind of feel like everything is a little bit of a failure, but
Sure is that.
I hate feeling like I published something that I didn't spend enough time on, or I rushed, or I pushed, or forced, or something like
Well,
that.
some things just come. I mean, like some, it's like I mean, the muse will give you a poem or two, but
Yeah.
she'll never give you a book. So,
No,
it's
that's
like,
true.
so it's like, it is just kind of, gift and struggle, but,
But I've found too,
you're doing just fine. I mean,
yeah.
I think it's great that you don't publish a book every 2 years. I
Yeah.
do.
Yeah. I
I do.
can't. I
I don't want to, actually.
yeah. I just don't write that way.
There's just too
But
much poetry anyway.
there is too much poetry, and it sucks because I tell people a lot, like in when I talk with them for manuscript consults and things, like I mean, I know the desire, like if you've been trying to get your book out for 15 years,
Well, that's a
it's
whole,
like
that's a
it's that
different thing.
sucks. But like, a lot of people too, it's like they want to get a book out so bad, and I'm like, well, the problem is that a lot of times people get books out and they're still really depressed because nobody reviewed it, and they can't get it in bookstores, and there's a whole other set of problems, you
Well,
know?
that's the
So
exhausting part about being a poet. It's
yeah, it really.
expensive, and it's expensive to write, and it's expensive to live, because what you realize is there's really nothing out there. I had this horrible student who I won't name years ago, something horrible, whatever, just like dim. And the majority of the people I work with are like just like stunning and remarkable. It's just been beautiful as of late. And yeah, I love my students, but this person was like, "So what was it like to be a finalist for the national?" He kept asking me this question. I was like, "I don't know." It was like 12 weeks of my life, and weirdly, it was embarrassing. So I don't really remember it. And it's kind of like prize culture and all that stuff. It means nothing, And it's I don't know. I think it's a drag that we have that in arts, because I think it really provincializes it, right? And I don't really believe in the culture of it. And I actually think I don't write for anything other than the poetry gods.
But I love
That's my goal. The fact that you admire my work,
Right, that's what I was just gonna say, is that like,
that's my
yeah,
prize. That's my
right.
prize.
I'm
The
like,
fact
if Peter likes my work, I'm like so happy.
Yeah, if a poet I truly admire, I think is real, likes my work, younger, older, that's it. I mean, and like you, I'm old. I knew a lot of people who are gone now, who I was really lucky to have their favor, And but the other thing, as a young person, I just never took on the arguments of my elders, because I realized, like with Rosemary, it's like they've earned it. Like they have a reason for it. I'm not taking it on. But I remember coming up, people would take on the arguments of this. I was like, it made no sense to me. Like I had a
You
fine.
mean for instance, like, oh,
They
he
just
doesn't
fit.
read Rilke. Like,
They would. They would. Yeah. Yeah.
you're not gonna like start just repeating how she feels about Rilke as
That's
your own
right.
feelings.
No. In fact, I respect her opinion, because I know it comes from a place of measured thought. She has a reason for it.
Yeah, and it's poetry, such a personal in a way, like.
It is.
She has such a, like you were saying, and she can't listen to Wagner and things, you know, she has these other reasons why, and there's no reason why we all have to like the same thing at the same time at all,
Yeah, and then
which
there's the
is,
things you liked at one point that you it's like I like that, and then there's the things like I don't know, and then you come to it like 5 years later, it's like, oh, wait a minute, I
I mean,
really
I didn't, I remember, I never liked Rilke. I was like, what is this? You know, it just seemed so cheap. Like, I don't know. I thought it was kind
cheesy.
of like cheesy. I didn't,
Oh,
it
see,
didn't.
I am cheesy. That's the problem.
But
I
yeah,
I'm like
I,
I like oh, my poems. I'm like over the top guy. So,
yeah,
but you only live
me
once.
too.
But the thing is that
But I hadn't even really read it. I just like,
I remember fi I never heard of him. I remember finding this in a bookstore, because I came up through the modernists, right? And Ezra Pound was like a gateway drug for me. When I was like 15, I learned so much about the history of poetry, and that's what he gave us, is this, the fact that if a poem's any good, it's always good. And he also was this amazing person, an animist who could reach into the 7th century or 8th century BC, and he could bring out the absolute spirit of that moment, and create a persona, which is what his early poems are called. He
That's
wore
right.
a mask, which is kind of what we all do as poets. It's like Spicer's after Lorca. I mean, when you're young, you read X and you try to write like X. And you can't write like X, and you realize really quickly, no, you can't. You failed that. But what you begin to realize, oh, this is who I am. And this is what I mean by the affiliated voices. Like all these things, all these various things that have given us wings, they're in us. We perform them in this other way, And I feel like all the poets that I love, I don't know. I think that there's a custodial duty to being a poet. I think we bring them back into the world of light and speech. We love them. We love one another. Like we're like this. Yeah. I mean, so I always feel like I'm contemporary with, who, I don't know,
You mean the dead?
like a 1st century poet, a 7th century poet. Like to me, if it's any good, it's always present. And that's a beautiful technology of poetry. And what is that? And I'm trying to think about it. Maybe it's because, like what Rilke is giving us, there's really like a basic set of things that we experience in this thing we call living. And so, like, poems somehow are these renditions of these basic things, which is desire, loss, anger, frustration. You know, it's like we have these set things we go through, and maybe that's why they've been so companionable all these years. I'm going to take all that away. What I want to say is the three things that I most love about poetry and what I'm interested in is mystery, presence, and intimacy. Those are the three things that I love. And that's all here in the Rilke. Yeah. So when I was 20, I found this book, this David Young translation, in a used bookstore. And I came home, I was like, this is mind blowing. I'd be like reading it to my friends. I actually thought I discovered Rilke, you know? And then one of my teachers was like, no, he's actually quite well known.
Yeah.
But the Duino elegies, you know, like we think about Spring and All, or we think about, you know, we think about these long poem sequences that were written in the first part of the 20th century. The Duino elegy is simply one of the greatest, you know, right, sequence poems that we have.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a fan of the Sonnets of Orpheus, I must confess.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I don't know. This is like undone and unstrung.
Yeah.
The elegies are just like, they're big and messy, and they're constantly contradicting themselves. And like that whole thing we try to unpack about the father tasting, it's like, I can't say for me. I mean, I guess if we have, you know, a Rilke scholar here, they could break it down for us, but
it doesn't mean one thing.
That's it.
Everything is set up to be unpacked and unpacked forever. And he didn't even, he didn't have it all worked out. Surely. I mean, no real poet does. Right. I mean,
no, I'm constantly discovering my work.
Yeah. It's like, that's why poetry is so unique. You know, I talked with Daniel Tutt on his podcast about philosophy.
Daniel who? Daniel who?
Daniel Tutt. He's a philosopher and Marxist.
Okay.
And he's wonderful, and he's doing such good work. But anyway, we were talking about philosophy and poetry and the age old sort of rivalry between them, and Plato banishing the poets and all that. But, you know, there's something about philosophy where, in a way, like, it has to be mapped out in advance. The argument defendable, laid out, and having part, you know, in you can deconstruct it in this really interesting way. But with poetry, it's like, I think people feel unnerved because it deals with philosophical issues, but you can't say, this is this poet's argument against this poet's argument. And even though Rilke has these beliefs and tendencies that he's going towards, the importance of this sort of inwardness that is important in a contradictory way to looking outward and things like that, but none of it, it's all so well, like you said, they contradict each other from poem to poem, and he keeps turning it and seeing it different angles, and it's strange and mysterious,
but also real that he contradicts. I mean, that's like, yeah,
it mimics reality.
Yeah.
And oh God, that reminds me of something you were saying earlier, which
take your time.
Oh, you were in the beginning of our conversation, you were talking about the poem being what was the word you used about time?
That it disrupts the clock and opens time to a different time signature. No,
right. Exactly. And when you think about how we've constructed time, that there's something about the poem that it's like it creates the it disrupts time, because that is almost that is what is reality, is like this out of time. That it has this consciousness that's bigger than the body, bigger than the self, bigger than the I, that can lead out into nature, and can go back in time and forward in time, but is constantly present.
Mm-hmm.
There's this in presence.
Yes.
The pure event maybe establishes.
Well, no, I mean, I think the word that you like is consciousness.
Yeah.
Consciousness is presence.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, consciousness is something we share.
Yeah.
It's like we all, it's like we have these instruments that we tune shit in. It's like we share it, you know?
Yeah.
And on all the studies that have been going on in the world with, you know, I hate digital culture, but they have all these recording instruments now, and they can now pick up sounds that are, you know, here's our range. It's like a mid band, and then all below it and above it, they can now capture all of these sounds in the natural world. And it turns out that every single thing is speaking and is
So
art
great.
and is articulate. Actually, has like an articulated language. It's
Yeah.
like
Oh my God.
mammals have individuated sounds for each one of its offsprings, right?
Oh.
It's like if you play water, you know, 30 feet away from a plant, this like a speaker, the plant will grow towards the water sound, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So everything's awake. I mean, everything.
Yeah.
So what is that? It's not the way in which we, our instrument, our wetware understands consciousness, but everything is alive and speaking.
Well, when you were talking about I'm this sort of vehicle for the voice as I make the poem, you know, if one could be somehow in a state that is able to write the unseen language and the unheard language that we don't even know, somehow to translate that and to be in conversation with it within art, right? Maybe too, I think. When Rilke's talking about, oh, the stage in which we can sit down and let the play finally begin is when we're able to make art and be in some sort of concert with or harmony with the greater consciousness of being, which is beyond, you know.
And he brings up constellations and stars in this book,
Right, he does.
and so to me, right, from boyhood on, I'm a space nerd, but always have been. But I guess if I had an autobiographical piece in my work, I guess the journey for me, I've come to identify over years, is that I just want to be the right size. I don't want to be bigger or smaller than anything. I just want to be the right size. I want to be tuned, right? And one of the ways that I came upon this was just as a boy standing. I mean, I don't know about you. I had serious Catholic training. They're constantly putting God in me, you know. It's a big ask for a 7-year-old. It's like nonstop God. But then, you know, I'm trying to really figure it out. My father's a scientist, very devotional. At any rate, for me, where I grew up in Western Mass in the Berkshires, you know, the sky was black and you could see the entire Milky Band. And I remember just standing there under that as a boy, looking up and just realizing, wow, I'm part of everything and I'm nothing at the same time. And
Yeah.
it felt incredibly, it just felt like a majesty to realize that I am part of this, and I'm like just not even, I'm just like a piece of it.
And
But yeah, go ahead.
well, I was going to say it reminds me of you saying too that realization that the world has nothing to do with me, but at the same time, it has everything to do with you because
Yeah.
you make it, you make the world.
I have that line in one of my poems at the beginning. Landscape is a made thing to see the mind seeing itself. To see
Yeah.
thought, a wing and night, the long brooding, and it goes on. Anyway, yeah. So, but you know, embarrassingly talking about this elegy and thinking about my poem, I who sent me, it's just like, wow, Rilke's like, he's like, you know, I don't know, what's the underwriting a lot of what I'm doing,
Yeah.
which freaks me out. Like, because even like the migratory bird and all of that, like, I'm gonna read that poem, okay?
Yeah, please.
Okay, I mean, it's
So this
not.
is your poem called.
This is my poem that you mentioned, which everyone seems to mention, which is a weird poem to me. It's called I Am Who Sent Me, but I'm thinking of it in relation to what we just read in the fourth elegy. I am who sent me. To have died in youth and remain, to be good with that, to forget now who was speaking, someone was always speaking. To be in the yesterday of today, lost in the morning's psychotropic green. But the verb is to be vigilant and hungry across time, along with the words I love, blinking in the face of it. Look for faces and you find them everywhere, that leafy elm becoming a mouth. Overhead, voices angular and taut rebound in space with an antique question. Where are you now? Now only words for lost things, language marching into empire, starving the words. Light throwing rhythmic shadows, Doppler and strange. Where are you? Things for last things. Still at this almost moment, a voice to come as sunrise and remember the mother. And the father everywhere inside migrating birds, so brief, so gone, this was the legacy of dew. To learn these origins as the origin of water. Unguarded, you wake and open into your face, freestyle, fathomless. To see that far into oneself with only a tear for a mirror. The shape of it, I keep it close as a shield against time. It's just like, okay.
I just fucking love that line so much, to see that far into oneself with only a tear for a mirror.
Yeah.
That's just so good.
But yeah, I mean, and then, you know, like the mother, the father, the migrator, it's like there's a lot of stuff. It's a lot of, it's just, yeah. I mean, Rilke's here. I mean, I don't know.
Rilke is here. I mean, but it's not just that Rilke's here, is that you're both in the same world and you both are tapped into these, you know, yes, they're archetypal. Yes, they're shared. Yes, they're ancient. I mean, that's why, you know, I was at this talk that Emily Wilson gave on the Iliad this morning, you know, I was
how was that?
But it was beautiful. You know, it was beautiful.
I just read her Odyssey, by the way. Go ahead.
Well, Ben just read the Iliad. He just did a little class on it and he's been reading me parts. Yeah, it's awesome. And she, you know, she was showing different translations side by side. And I just then coming to her translation, I was just, I'm so appreciative of it. Because I feel like she really she has a sensibility of a kind of the poetry that just gets at the nuance of the language that I just adore. But I was thinking about the ancientness of it, and that, you know, we think of ancient texts as just ancient poetry that's not relevant to the concerns we have now, but it's amazing how
not at all it's now
you know, there's different contexts socially, of course, and they mean different things to us now, like, oh, you know, honor was like very different then than we understand honor now, so we have to consider that when reading it, things like that. But the point I'm making is that, you know, we have these influences, whether we realize it or not, from all the poetry that's come before us.
That's it.
And it's not, and it's because we experience too the mother and the father and the phenomenon of migrating birds and the metaphors within those things, which are not just decorative.
No.
You know, they're full of living meaning and reality. And so we're all tapped into that. But it's like we all sit, there's like a subtle difference in how everybody makes their poem. So this, the individual writer, even if they're Homer and God knows where he got it all from, is like, it that matters too. Because like, for some reason, the individual experience, like we were talking about the autobiography, somehow that inflects and informs how the greater conversation is turned and looked at different angles, right? Because we all have nuance experiences, that things aren't just all the same, and yet they're shared.
Well, yeah, you have to, yeah, it has to, yeah, you have to make it new, as they say. You have to make it
yeah,
yours.
That's what she was saying too.
Is, but the thing about, you know, I mean, Homer is just like, here's the thing. We keep thinking that like the human record's long. Remember when I turned 50, I was like, boy, what if I have a party and I had 49 other people in the room who were all exactly 50 years old, like me at this moment. So that's 50 people. Okay. And if we had 50 people who were all 50, and you could somehow take that aggregate age, which you, if you add it up, it's 2,500 years. But if you could like line them up chronologically, we would be back in the 5th century Athens. We'd be back in,
Wow.
right?
Yeah.
So that's like 50,
Yeah.
that's like 50 people between me and that.
Yeah.
It's not even a big party.
I
It's
see what you
crazy.
mean. Yeah.
No, right? And it's
Yeah.
like if I had two other people, I'm around when Dickinson and Lincoln are around.
Yeah.
You know, so it's
Yeah.
like, so this idea that it's like, you know, I don't know. It's like, yeah, if we read about civilizations, you know, yeah, we have better medicine, but we also have better
But
weapons.
imagine all the incredible poetry and epiphanies and truths that have come before us that we're still trying to parse out, and so much that's lost to time. I mean, there could have been the most important and crucial epiphany about man and humanity that somebody had thousands of years ago, and it's lost now, but it will come back somehow, you know?
Well, yeah, but yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine. I mean, so much of what we have from the ancient world, we have by accident. You
Yeah,
know,
you mean that we still have it? Yeah.
it's by accident. We have
I
something
know, and
like
fragmented.
15% of it, you know,
Yeah.
or if that. But Homer is definitely not one person because basically it's basically, you know, decades and decades of rhapsodes, people who perform texts, you know, performing these different sagas, because every figure in the Odyssey and in the Iliad, every player comes from a town and they have their own saga about that warrior. So like what Homer does is Homer takes all of these various sagas and then he weaves them together, or whoever is woven together to make this kind of larger tapestry. And that's what's incredible. And the reason there's all these repetitions all the time is because it's almost like, you know, it's like a song. It's like a hook. You can freestyle and then you come back. You can freestyle again and then
Great.
you come back. Because, you know, it's like it wasn't written down until the 6th century, right? But
Right, so you had to have
it
these.
existed for 300 years anyway as an oral
Yeah.
text. So yeah, so it's definitely, you know, it's definitely not the product of a single author. But then this goes back to what I'm trying to say. Even you, Bianca Stone, your writing may not be, your writing might not be the product of a single author.
No.
You see what I mean? It's like
Yeah.
you're made up of all of these other voices, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, okay, so it comes through you, but it's, I don't know what I'm trying to say. But
Well, I mean,
Homer's amazing.
I mean, there's the direct influence of other writers that I've had throughout my life and poets that I read that I feel I'm consciously and unconsciously in conversation with. But then there's this sense of, you know, I have these little moments of like feeling this sense of something much older that, you know, of course, it's all, it's part of our bodies passed down, passed down, passed down, passed down, all the way back till the first, you know, strange thing that split into two and had a thought and died. You know, it's like that little tiny first thought that ever was is probably in all of us. And
And it took, by the way, billions of years for, you know, like maybe the first single cell thing that was alive was years 4 billion years old. So there's like 3.5 billion, they think. But by the time we get to complex life, it's not that long ago. It
yeah,
took
it's really
it
not.
took a long time to like, and so,
And look what happens is like we're like
and
killing
but
ourselves.
and the unit, you
Death
know,
instinct is strong.
the galaxy we're within, you know, what's the likelihood that there's another, you know, planet that has life on it as we know it? It's probably not likely. I mean, it could definitely be likely in other galaxies, but you know, we might be it for the Milky Way. And for whatever reason, we've been given like these eyes and ears to like to witness.
Yeah,
And
to witness,
I mean, to me, that's like, I
to
don't know.
look.
I guess if we just kind of focused on that as a people, it might be different. I mean, we're not a planetary species at all. Like, planetary species means that we all live in harmony with everything, and we're not even close to that, so that's a drag.
It is a drag. I mean, it's.
You know,
I was walking to the. Get the trash can, or I was walking the dog and then getting the trash cans, and it was dark out. And I was like really scared walking in the dark. And then I was like, all of a sudden, I thought of deer and bears in the woods that just live in the dark in the woods. And they're just part of, It sounds so dumb and simple when I say it out loud, but like
No, I know.
I had this sudden like experience of like, oh my God, like I'm so removed from being like just in the woods in the dark, and this is where I belong.
Or just
I'm so removed from that.
connected to the sun, basically. We're just not.
Not connected to the sun either.
I mean, the other thing about the electric light or fall, I mean, that's like, yeah, I mean, again, this stuff is all new, right? I
Oh, I
mean,
love. Did you watch Dave? Have you? Do you like David Lynch?
of course.
I'm like really into the Twin Peaks season three, the return,
You mean the 18 part one?
the new
Yeah.
series he did.
It's
I just
insane. It's
finished it.
might be the greatest thing he's ever done.
I was like so fucking sad when I watched the last episode that I was like I because every episode I just savored. I loved it so much. But he so has this obsession with the electric plug and electricity, and that something happened. Something happened when we made the bomb and that blew up, and that sort of like opened some sort of let some evil into the world that exists. One thing that's so great about that is that he makes an actual scene, a material thing out of the unseen and archetypal events of the mind. But what's important about him doing that, because plenty of people like, oh, make magic into a fiery ball that they throw. But somehow what David Lynch does that he's so masterful at is that it's so connected to the living people's weird world that it's like, what I'm saying is, it's a metaphor and not a metaphor, and that's how he shows it. It's like it's perfectly it's perfectly fantasy and reality at the same time. It's almost
Well,
like
yeah, but he makes his work out of like a deep practice of meditation. So it's completely
does
like,
he?
oh yeah, he's a big member of transcendental meditation his whole life. Oh yeah. So what he does is everything he gets is paintings. His scripts, his ideas, it all comes from meditation. And so
Oh, beautiful. That makes so much sense.
what we respond to though is that kind of like that particular like logic or illogic, that logic that he has that allows for disturbance, it allows for like contradiction, but really just allows for like mystery. Like you can't see it all. You can't see it all. Like the figure of Kyle MacLachlan in that series where he's like a golem. He can't speak. He's
Oh,
constant.
yeah.
Yeah,
Davy
but that's
Jones.
like, but that's what it's like. That's what it's like to have a dream when you're paralyzed, right? It's like having sleep paralysis. It's like, it's coming. I mean, I don't know. It's so unsettling, but we've all had it. You can't.
But to the Kyle MacLachlan evil Cooper doppelganger
I
guy,
know, I know.
that's part of us too. And then in the final episode, it's very fungible between the two of them. Even though he's gone, you still see glimpses of him. And so that's again that like, yes, these are all parts of our psyche
Yeah, all part.
and selves, but and they're made and they're sort of they're separated and made into symbols. And but that's what happens in our dreams. And I see these people same kind of people in my dreams. Some are sadists, and some are and manipulative. Some are feel so benevolent. They have like, random, they're random seeming. But I've had this belief too, and well, I have a knowledge that yes, it's in my head and not real and immaterial, and yet it some part of it is completely real.
No, it's absolutely real.
And a consciousness separate than my own that is also part of my consciousness, and it
Yeah.
comes in and out. And that's why we can have, that's why in myths we can recognize certain figures,
Yes.
and it's like, oh yes, that figure, that trickster figure, he's like a real thing. It's like a real phenomenon.
Yeah, I agree. And you know what I've always thought? Why, Jung talks about the collective unconscious and this idea of the recognizable, types, archetypes. Okay, so this is interesting, right? For tens of thousands of years, the human animal negotiated space through the sky, through stars, right? So like that was the map. That was how we negotiated, like I know where you
Speaking
are
about
because I
being in
know
the
where the
dark.
I know I know I know where the sun is, right? Like it's all about that triangulation of this point in space, that you know, that height of the mountain, and then where it's like, so it's kind of like, I don't know, through this weird gear of the sky, you know where your beloved is. You can locate them. You know where the most intimate people are. You know where your dead are buried. But it's like we don't have that now. Now we have
No,
Google Maps. Now I have
now we have
Google
Google
Maps.
Maps. We've got the internet. We don't look up at the sky anymore.
Yeah. My first book, you know, is called Periplume, and a periplume is a way of reckoning through the stars. It's an ancient form of reckoning. Yeah, because why? Again, about space nerd, it allowed me to accommodate a vertical imagination without being theist, right?
Oh, I love that.
Because I
Yeah,
believe
fine.
it is. It's just like shit's way bigger than us. And the more science that I read, it's like it doesn't even diminish the idea that it's like some form of like just majesty, you know? It's like a divinity in a way. I mean, it's just like it doesn't ever take. The more we learn, the more mind-blowing it is, the more we find out about stuff.
And it's so fun to know that we'll never know everything until we're dead. And it's like the not
Do you mean
knowing.
until we're dead? We're not going to know it then. What do you mean we're not going to? What, you think when you're dead, you know?
I thought maybe when we're dead we'd know,
We,
but
you know what I'll
maybe.
think? I've experienced so many losses in the last decade or more. And now I'm dealing with my own stuff. And it's like, I have this really weird, this is, you don't have to tape this, but I was actually thinking that what if dying is like the ultimate orgasm?
Yeah,
You know what I
I
mean? It's
think
just,
it must
it's
be.
just like,
You've, yeah.
and you're just gone, and you're
Yeah.
just part of everything.
Well,
That's what I want it to be.
I don't think you're off, you know, because I mean, we know that orgasming and se and death have been aligned before,
Yeah.
but there's, of
The Petit
course,
Mort, yeah.
yeah, there's the, I've experienced visually in my head the orgasm at the end of something very important, right? So there's like it's so interesting because the erotic and the sexual and the lovers is such an issue for Rilke too. But in
Gee,
terms,
not for me. No, go ahead. Sorry,
yeah,
yeah.
I know, right? Well,
Not
I've got it all figured out over
that.
here. I know it's actually that element's been helpful for me too to just wrestle with because so many most people are not nuanced about the, you know, for them union and love is simplistic.
Really? I don't know.
I don't know, in terms of like love poems, I guess.
Oh, well, love poems are really,
I don't know, maybe
they're
it's now
so,
that I say that, I'm like, that's not true to love.
they're, no, I mean, everybody's within their ken, but
I
yeah,
maybe songs. I'm thinking of Taylor Swift.
love poetry is so hard to write,
It is.
but they're so great. Actually, I think that I've written some really good ones in this new book. I really
Oh,
do.
that's exciting. Wait, you do have a new book?
No, I'm saying in my new book,
Oh, an
First
elegy.
Elegy. Yeah.
No, I, well, that's why I was thinking of Rilke's, you know, his, you know, he may fight against intimate love. You know, you lovers, blah blah blah. But he's also constantly on about lovers in here, and
He was getting it on all the time. I
and
mean,
yeah,
he
and
had
he was,
is he slept with some major women.
yeah, and he always had a woman, and love was important for him. But yeah, I thought of, I saw that in this book too. There's so much love here because I love, I'm here, you know.
That's it. That poem was over the top.
I'm immortal because I love, I am here.
No, in my outrage, I am a, no, it's like what is it? What is it?
Ecstatic joy in its variance.
Yeah, but what's the, it's like, sure, read the last like five lines.
Like a seam through the sky, glitter, sometime youth. Surely this is about the one thing you do to me, places not even music has touched. And in my outrage, I am immortal because I love, I am here. Great
Yeah.
line breaks. See, and all your line breaks here make it have multiple meanings, which I love.
I don't know. I mean,
That unfamiliarity with one's own poetry that you were saying, you know, I don't know what the fuck this poem is, you know, but approaching your poems and saying, ah, how did how.
but when I read it, I do. See, that's the thing. It's like when I give a reading, all to me is an occasion to visit with my work.
Oh, totally.
And
That's.
basically, all I'm doing when we go to at least a good reading we're listening to the poet listen to what they've done.
Yeah, that's why
And
it's.
every occasion is another occasion to discover it, you know?
That's
So.
why I don't know about you, but I like reading is one of my favorite things, and
Yeah,
but
you love it. We're good at it.
we're
Yeah.
yeah, but that but it's also a great source of torment for me because if I don't like think I gave a good reading or I read the wrong poems or missed something, like I'll fall into like the deepest depression for and not torture, self-torture
There
about
is
it.
that, but there's nothing worse than going to a reading that sucks. That makes me
Oh,
hate poetry.
yeah.
There's just so much, I mean, Bianca, there's just so much poetry now. And there's so much poetry that's my trauma is bigger than your trauma. And I just find it to be, it doesn't really bring us together. It only separates us.
I think the problem is aligned with what we've been talking about, which is people misunderstand the I and personal experience. And it's like narrative is so, there's something about narrative that's so important to the poem, that's so grounding to it and storytelling. But it's not, we
You do that really well. See, here's the thing. Like, you love Sharon Olds. She was your teacher, et cetera. You don't write anything like Sharon Olds, like, at all.
I
See,
don't write, yeah.
you love her. It's like, it's not even in your work. And it's like,
Yeah.
but there is narrative in your work,
Yeah.
right? And there is this notion that the voice is telling us something that could be a confession, and we're overhearing something, but really the voice is just kind of like learning things as it goes in your work, right? That's what's great
Yeah.
about it. And you are interested in narrative, but it's so circuitous. And that, I don't know. I mean, it's just like, what's the next line gonna be? What's the
Yeah,
next
well,
next line gonna
I
be?
don't
And
want
that's
to.
how I hear it,
Yeah.
and I love that. Like,
Yeah.
yeah. And
I'd
you are a great reader because, yeah, because you, yeah, you just are. But as far as like not reading the right poem, I know that one, but that's bullshit, you know? And it's true that some readings are like, I gave one at the church at St. Mark's 2 or 3 weeks ago, and it was fucking great. I was there, I was present to every syllable. And so therefore everybody was present to every syllable.
Yep.
And I serve all I had to do, I just served my work.
Yeah.
Remember early on I had to give a big reading at this festival, and I was like nervous. And this older poet came up to me and said, okay, so it's great. You're allowed to be nervous now and insecure. It's great. And then when you get off the stage, you can be nervous and insecure.
Right.
But when you get on stage, all you have to do is serve the poem. Just read
Right.
the poem. Just read the poem. And
Yeah.
as mundane as that sounds, it was like a real gift in my early life.
It's such good advice because I had like a personal realization that was similar where like I realized, oh, I have my poems up here with me. I'm not up here alone. You know, I'm here
Yeah.
to like have the poem do its thing. And when I start reading, I always feel better, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And they're way more
Yeah.
articulate than anything I'm saying here today, which is like all over the
Yeah.
place. Yeah, like I like what Spicer says in one of the lectures is at the end of his life. He says, the poems are right where I'm wrong. I always
Right,
love that. It's
right.
true. That's
I mean,
true. It's so good. I love it's true. Yeah.
yeah, and I think my poems know way more than I do,
They
and
do.
I want it that way.
Well, that's why you can keep hearing them, you know?
Well, I think that's what I was saying about the autobiography, which I just didn't finish that thought, and I don't want it to hang, but
Go.
just to say that like are there's something in us and at work through us that knows way more than we do. So we can't think that we know everything about our own autobiographical experience and what that means and what family is and what people want to hear about our family and our life and our traumas. We have to I think
Transform.
yeah, we have to transform and transcend what we think we know, and how we do that is to dream with it somehow, right? To and that's where things like free association can come in really handy,
Yeah,
where it's
those.
like, you know, and musicality and form, because if you follow the musicality and the form and you don't go into it thinking I'm writing a poem about this
Ever.
and this is how I want it to come off, and I want to come
Never.
off as the victim of this instance, or I want to come off as, you know, I want to come off as this is a love poem, whatever it is, you've got to go in with that unknowing openness. and see what happens, because
Well,
you do start with an inkling usually,
yeah,
but
you know,
not.
you start with an impulse. It's like a you start with an impulse, and it's like a carrier frequency, you know? It like passes through you, and then you can begin to attach phrases and words and ideas and things to it, you know? And then you can shape it and then give that meaning, you know? And that's what I mean about, like, I've come to realize that when I write, I'm really being spoken.
You're being spoken.
Yeah, I'm not speaking. I'm being
Yeah,
spoken.
I love that. When I write, I'm being spoken.
You know what I mean? It's just like,
Well,
yeah.
isn't that nice to be off the hook a little? You know, you don't have to speak and no, and no. You.
No, I mean, in fact, I actually believe that not knowing is a very useful tool to make meaning from.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like it is.
Yeah, that idea that Adam Phillips talks about, I think it was him, that not knowing is in service to knowing. So,
Yeah, where is that? Because, you know, I'm now in correspondence with him.
oh yeah, I love that he did it. Okay, yeah,
It's
Adam Phillips
amazing.
did a talk on Peter Gizzi's poetry.
It's great. And Schuyler, who I love.
Oh, and
It's,
Skylar, I didn't know that.
yeah, it was an essay. It's a talk I gave on Schuyler and then 30 pages of my work. And I wrote him and I said, because this other person, can you send me his address? And I was like, you have no idea. It's just like I knew Jimmy Schuyler in my early life when I was a nascent poet, you know. And I only knew him for like 4 years because he died suddenly. And we had big correspondence, and he was so supportive. And I think he's a god, which he is.
He
And
was so, one of my early influences
he's a
for sure.
god. He just is. He gets better and better. And time is telling us that. And but I was like, but the idea that 30 years later, his work and my work would be in conversation in your company is like, that's the gift. I mean, that's like a gift, you know?
That's the prize, baby. That's
Yeah,
the
I'm saying,
prize.
no, that is the, you know, that's
That
the,
is the fucking prize.
no, that's the prize. You're like the Jasper Johns. It's just behind me. You know what
I
I
see.
mean?
It's so beautiful.
You know what
Is
I
that, and
mean?
you got a Trevor Wingfield behind you?
Oh yeah, I got a bunch
Yeah.
of Trevors.
I love it.
No, I mean, yeah, we know good people.
Yeah, we
I
do.
wish you still did your cartoons, though. I actually really loved your cartoons.
Oh, I can't do it anymore.
No,
I
it's
can't.
fun, but I love them because
I'm glad.
they were great. I thought they were really good.
I think, I was just
Yeah.
looking at the Ann Carson book again and thinking about it and stuff. I had to do a talk on it, so I was looking at it again. But yeah, I don't know, maybe someday.
Whatever. It was what you did then to find out, learn something.
I know it's such a psychological phenomenon, though. I can't, I
But
even just thinking.
I'm really loving your new poems, though, the ones I've read and the ones I've heard.
Thank you.
You know, and then I love there's so many great poems in your recent book. Yeah, it really is. I mean, the Jesus poem is just off the chain.
Oh my God, I like read that.
That's an amazing poem. What's the first thing? Was it like Jesus didn't realize that he was a simile? Like, what's the
Oh
first
yeah.
line? No, it's so good. Can you
Yeah,
remember it?
it's like they say Jesus couldn't admit to himself that he was a simile.
Yeah, it's so great. So great. You see, the thing is, you get a phrase like that, you can go anywhere. That's the thing. You got to catch a phrase, and then that's what I'm saying about the character. You catch that. That is a large enough idea that you can make anything happen underneath that.
I mean, catching those
You
phrase,
do.
that's what a po that's how you I'm looking for those, I'm
Well,
looking
that's
for
why I haven't
those.
started a book yet, you know, because I'm waiting. Like the first poem in Fierce Elegy is called Find Spot Unknown. And I was like, okay, you go to a museum and you'll see an artifact, 800 BC Assyria. And then you go to the next artifact that says Find Spot Unknown. And I always loved it. I was like, oh, I see. It's an artifact of an unknown origin.
That's
Wow,
so cool.
it's just like a poem. And then and it was like, oh yeah, so what does that mean? It's a real mystery. It's a thing. It's a real mystery. And so that was like, that allowed me to then, for whatever reason, the first poem in all my books is the first poem of that book. And it's an
I
idea
love
that's
that.
large enough that then the book just happens. I haven't gotten it yet. But now that it's done, I have no excuse. I have to start all over again. I mean, I have one small poem, but I can't It doesn't open a book.
Well,
Is
this
it,
came out last year. I mean,
can I recite it to you? It's short. Do you mind?
Yes, please.
Okay,
I'd be
it's
honored.
okay. Suddenly, street light can do things other light can't. All that was to be was what it was, clownish light, nothing more. Then suddenly you find yourself in something's abject glory, a trill of color on dirty winter ice. Street light can do things other light can't, to wander the soft dark outside the circle of light, ragged circle from the street light. It was always this way here. Darkness, like expression of doubt, spills over when excess thought leads to starlings, a geometry taking wing.